Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 10th of November, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. Is episode 15 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after the LGBT news roundup, we're going to have a look at the shocking and scandalous issue of interracial marriage and what the Holy Bible has to say about it. We'll also examine the history of its prohibition, particularly in the United States, and try to find some analogies with today's tooth-and-nail struggle for same-sex marriage. Then, in our movie review section, we'll have a look at Michael Moore's new documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so. And let's start with a post-mortem examination of the elections that took place in various localities across the United States last Tuesday, the 3rd of November. And of course, the big news of the day and most disappointing news was the fact that marriage equality was defeated in the state of Maine. So just to recap what happened there, in April this year, the Senate of Maine approved a bill to end discrimination in civil marriage and open it up to same-sex couples. That bill was then approved by the House of Representatives, and a day later, on the 6th of May, the governor of Maine, John Baldacci, signed it into law. It was due to come into force on the 11th of September, but unfortunately opponents of same-sex marriage gathered enough signatures on a petition to get the matter decided by a referendum. And that vote took place last Tuesday and tragically came out in favour of repealing the new law. 53% against same-sex marriage and 47% in favour. So a very sad and frustrating loss there for marriage equality. But let's try to look on the bright side. This was a referendum on a piece of legislation. It wasn't a constitutional amendment, which was what happened in other states of the US, most famously in California last year. So that means they didn't ban same-sex marriage in Maine by amending the Constitution, they just rejected a piece of legislation. And of course, the state Congress can just pass the legislation again, and maybe again, and again, until they get it through, or until the opponents can't get enough signatures to organize one of those so-called people's vetoes. Of course, the opponents of marriage equality might now try to get a constitutional amendment approved to ban same-sex marriage, but I think that will probably be a lot tougher for them. The other interesting question is why our side lost so badly when the polls were predicting a much tighter race. Some have been saying that this was due to what's known as the Bradley effect. That is, that people, when asked by pollsters, might be ashamed to say how they're really going to vote because they don't want to seem like a bigot or politically incorrect. So they give the nice-sounding answer to the pollster, but then unleash their bigotry when it comes time to actually vote. So maybe that was the reason. Nobody really knows, of course. And I have to say, it just amazes me how these anti-marriage equality campaigns can be so effective in persuading people to leave their homes and go down to the polling booth to vote on something that has absolutely nothing to do with them, that has no effect on their lives whatsoever, which is clearly the case for same-sex marriage. And yet they come out in droves to vote against it. Well, I guess it's partly due to the clever fear campaign run by the opponents of marriage equality, both in Maine and in California last year, where they make it look as if this same-sex marriage issue is somehow about them, somehow a threat to them. And particularly in Maine and California, they ran completely misleading ads to say that the referendum was all about teaching homosexuality in our schools to our poor, innocent young children. Now, I don't know if you remember those much-parodied Gathering Storm ads released in the US earlier this year by NOM, the National Organization for Marriage, who are now the main anti-same-sex marriage lobby group in the US. Well, apart from the fact that they were so bad that they were funny, the part that really struck me about those ads is when they explicitly say that same-sex marriage is all about them. Let me quote from the ad here. "Some who advocate for same-sex marriage have not been content with same-sex couples living as they wish. Those advocates want to change the way I live." And they say that twice in the ad. "They want to bring the issue into my life. My freedom will be taken away," etc., etc. And I guess if you think about it, that's really the only way they can win, because same-sex marriage obviously has no effect on anyone else, so they have to try to make it look as if it does, as if this is all about forcing something onto straight people, as if that's the real agenda of same-sex couples. They don't really want to get married. This is all about you. This is all about forcing you to change your lifestyle or something. So if you can make people think that it's all about them, it seems you can actually get them to go out and vote to stop it. Amazing, but true. And the final point to note about what happened in Maine is that the primary source of funding for the anti-same-sex marriage side, well, most of the funding came from out of state, from the NOM, National Organization for Marriage, but of the in-state funding, most of it, over $550,000, in fact, came from the Catholic Church. Now, wasn't that nice of them? They took time out from their other charitable activities to take away rights from LGBT people. How sweet. As one blogger put it, the Catholic Church was to the Maine campaign what the Mormons were to the California campaign last year, the primary engine of hate and bigotry. However, all was not gloom and doom on November the 3rd, because on the west coast of the US, in Washington state, the extended domestic partnership law was passed by the referendum they had there. I think they haven't quite finished counting the vote there yet, because it was largely a postal vote from what I understand, But the last figures I saw had our side leading 52% to 48%, with no way the other side could make up that ground. So that means that same-sex couples in Washington State will now have the option to enter into a domestic partnership which gives them all the same rights and responsibilities as a marriage, just not the name marriage. So that's an important victory there, and that will mean a lot of very practical and useful rights for a lot of people in Washington State. And finally, the other interesting result from the November 3rd elections is that a major push is now on for same-sex marriage in the state of New Jersey. Not that there was any victory in New Jersey. In fact, the Democrat governor there, John Corzine, lost, and a nasty right-wing Republican, Chris Christie, was elected as governor. However, this has created a two-month window of opportunity for activists and the legislature to try to push same-sex marriage through there, because the new governor doesn't take over until mid-January. And both the legislature and the current Democrat governor have said that they support same-sex marriage. So there's a big campaign underway now to make them put their money where their mouth is and get same-sex marriage passed and signed into law there by January. And fortunately, New Jersey doesn't allow one of those awful people's vetoes like in Maine. So if the legislature and governor get it done, there's not much that the opponents can do. So let's hope that that happens and that we'll hear some good news from New Jersey by the new year. Fingers crossed. All right, moving away from the United States now to a part of the world where LGBT people are about as oppressed as they possibly can be, and that is to Iran, where three young men have been convicted of homosexuality and are now awaiting execution any day now for their supposed crime. Now, this is really, really a grim situation, not just because they're going to be killed for homosexuality, but because of their ages. The youths were all under 18 when the alleged crime occurred. One of them was just 16. Two of the men, in fact, were also convicted without any witnesses testifying against them. The organization Human Rights Watch issued a press release on this case last Wednesday, November the 4th, calling on Iran to halt these executions. Iran, unfortunately, leads the world in executing juvenile offenders. At least seven were killed in 2008, and this year, 2009, so far they've killed at least three. Sarah Lee Whitson from Human Rights Watch summed it up perfectly. "Killing people for what they did as children is wrong and repellent, and killing them for alleged homosexual conduct is just as wrong and repellent." I couldn't have put it better myself. Let's just hope that pressure from both within and outside the country can save those men from what is looking like a senseless but imminent death. Okay, that's all our LGBT news for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll have a look at what we can learn from the Holy Bible about the scandalous issue of interracial marriage. So stay tuned for that here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman, and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Reveal by Roxette. Yes, that Roxette, the Swedish pop duo big in the late 80s and early 90s. Did you know that they're still around? And that song we just heard was released in 2007. And a lovely song it is. Now we move into the part of the show where we normally get into a skeptical analysis of something related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. But today we're going to do something slightly different, and we're going to have a look at religion and how it's been used to take away people's fundamental civil rights in various ways for many years now. So, dear listener, without further ado, I'd like to ask you to open your Bible, please, to Genesis chapter 9, verse 18. Found it? Okay, good. I'll lead the reading. Oh, and by the way, just for a bit of context, we're in the story of Noah here. You know, Noah and his ark and all the animals, that one. So we're at the point where the flood is over and the ark has landed on dry ground. Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, came out of the ark. Ham later had a son named Canaan. All people on earth are descendants of Noah's three sons. Noah farmed the land and was the first to plant a vineyard. One day he got drunk and was lying naked in his tent. Ham entered the tent and saw him naked, then went back outside and told his brothers. Shem and Japheth put a robe over their shoulders and walked backwards into the tent. Without looking at their father, they placed it over his body. When Noah woke up and learnt what his youngest son had done, he said, "I now put a curse on Canaan. He will be the lowest slave of his brothers. I ask the Lord my God to bless Shem and make Canaan his slave. I pray that the Lord will give Japheth more and more land and let him take over the territory of Shem. May Canaan be his slave." Now let's just read a little bit from the next chapter. That's chapter 10 of Genesis. After the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth had many descendants. Japheth's descendants had their own languages, tribes, and land. They were blah, 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 lots of strange names you've never heard of. Let's skip ahead to the good part. Ah, yes, verse 6. Okay. Ham's descendants had their own languages, tribes, and land. They were Ethiopia, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Then there's lots more names you've never heard of, blah, 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 and some of Canaan's descendants go off and live in Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, we all know how that ends. Then we get a list of Shem's descendants as well. Then we get to the end of chapter 10, where it says, "This completes the list of Noah's descendants. After the flood, their descendants became nations and spread all over the world." And that concludes the reading, dear listener. So there you have it, another sweet story from the Holy Book about how Ham saw his father naked, and so therefore, as is only fair, his descendants, many of whom went to Africa and some parts of the Middle East, were cursed to become slaves to all the other races. Actually, Genesis chapter 10, about the descendants of all the sons of Noah, is often called the Table of Nations, because it describes how all the various nations and races of the world today came about. And actually, this story of the curse of Ham and the Table of Nations from Genesis 9 and 10 was used to justify the enslavement of Africans by Europeans, particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries, and was also influential in theories of European racial superiority until the mid-20th century. So, if the Bible can be used to justify slavery and racism, what does it tell us about the mixing of the races? Well, the good Lord is quite clear when it comes to how he feels about this. Interracial marriage is a big no-no. please open once again your Holy Bible to the book of Numbers, chapter 25, verses 6 to 8. Later, Moses and the people were at the sacred tent, crying, when one of the Israelite men brought a Midianite woman to meet his family. By the way, dear listener, a Midianite woman is from a different tribe from the Israelites. Anyway, back to the reading. Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron the priest, saw the couple and left the crowd. He found a spear and followed the man into his tent, where he ran the spear through the man and into the woman's stomach. Well, serves him right, really. I mean, what was he thinking, bringing a Midianite woman home to meet the family? Oh, please, I mean, haven't these people heard of standards? Well, he got what was coming to him as far as I'm concerned. Now, let's have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 7, where Moses is addressing the Israelites. And he tells them, people of Israel, the Lord your God will help you take the land of the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. These seven nations have more people and are stronger than Israel. But when you attack them, the Lord will force them out of the land. Then you must destroy them without mercy. Don't make any peace treaties with them, and don't let your sons and daughters marry any of them. And rightly so, too. I mean, marriage to a Girgashite? What a preposterous idea. Now, let's have a look at Joshua 23, where Joshua says to the people of Israel, be sure to always love the Lord your God. Don't ever turn your backs on him by marrying people from the nations that are left in the land. Don't even make friends with them. And in the Good Book, you can find numerous other passages referring to the evils of marriage between the races. And so, therefore, naturally, in 1965, when a case on interracial marriage came before Judge Leon Bazeil in the state of Virginia, the good judge had this to say. Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. And but for the interference with his arrangement, there would be no cause for such marriages. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. Quite clear. And so, naturally, also on October 6th this year in the state of Louisiana, when a local justice of the peace, Keith Bardwell, was confronted by an interracial couple, a Negro man with a pure white woman, who actually had the cheek to ask him to issue a marriage license for them, well, naturally, he turned them down. And that decision created quite a media storm in the United States over the last few weeks, with civil rights groups and numerous public officials, including the Louisiana governor, calling for his resignation. And finally, last Tuesday, November 3rd, Keith Bardwell did resign as a justice of the peace. And the whole brouhaha is over, except that the couple that he refused to marry and who are now married by another justice of the peace are bringing a federal civil rights lawsuit against him. So it seems that it will hang around his neck for a little while longer. Now, of course, dear listener, I was, in fact, being facetious when I was talking about the evils of interracial marriage there, because for most people in their 40s or younger today, it seems absurd, ridiculous, unthinkable that interracial marriage could ever be prohibited. And yet, just over a generation ago, it was prohibited in many states of the United States. And one of the main justifications for that prohibition were those quotes that I just read to you from the Bible. They surface again and again when people are talking about why interracial marriage should be banned. And in fact, it wasn't until 1967 that those state bans on interracial marriage were finally overturned by the US Supreme Court. And I wanted to talk a bit about those laws today because I think it's useful to reflect on the history of the ban on interracial marriage to try to put the current bans on same-sex marriage into an historical perspective. Particularly after the loss for marriage equality in Maine last week, I know a lot of people are feeling very despondent and angry now. But when you look at this battle from a broader historical perspective, it's absolutely clear which way this issue is going and how it's going to end up. So it's also clear that in Maine and California, marriage equality activists may have lost the battles, but they will inevitably end up winning the war. So let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, let's get into an analysis of the history of the prohibition on interracial marriage in the United States. And let's see what we can learn from that for today's battles. So stay tuned for that here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was Mere Kwabon Me Joaye from the smash hit Bollywood movie from 1995, Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge, starring Shah Rukh Khan and Kajol, and actually the fifth biggest Bollywood hit of all time in terms of box office success. Of course, Kajol wasn't actually singing in that song. Bollywood movies use lip sync pretty much all the time, so the voice you actually heard there was that of Lata Mangeshkar. And Lata Mangeshkar is, in fact, an icon in herself, being one of Bollywood's best-known playback singers from the 1940s until today. And she actually held the Guinness Book of Records for many years for having made the most recordings in the world, over 30,000 songs in total, supposedly, and that was just up until the 1980s. Although I do wonder if that is humanly possible. And Lata Mangeshkar is also the oldest sister of that other most famous Bollywood singer of all time, Asha Bhosle. So a song there with a lot of history. Anyway, let's return to our examination of interracial marriage and have a look at the history of the anti-miscegenation laws and see what we can learn that's relevant for today. Yes, I just said the anti-miscegenation laws. Now, I know it's a strange word, miscegenation, but it means the mixing of the races. And as far as I can tell, three countries in modern history have had anti-miscegenation laws. That is, laws that prohibit marriage or even sometimes sex between people of different races. Those three countries were the United States, Germany during the Nazi era, and South Africa during the period of apartheid. Of course, that doesn't mean that there weren't or aren't prohibitions on interracial marriage in other parts of the world. It's just that these are the only three countries that incorporated it into their legal code. In fact, interracial marriage is still an enormous social taboo in probably most parts of the world and is effectively prohibited in many places still. Just think of the kinds of restrictions that exist in India, for example, against marriages between people of different castes. breaking those kinds of taboos often results in the murder of the couple. And similar social taboos are very, very common throughout the world. But as for countries that specifically had laws against it, the anti-miscegenation laws in Germany were in force from 1935 to 45 and prevented marriage or sex between Aryans and non-Aryans, non-Aryans basically meaning Jews, Gypsies and Blacks. And the laws in South Africa were in effect from 1949 until 1985 and prohibited marriage or sex between whites and non-whites. But let's come back to the United States because it had the longest lasting anti-miscegenation laws of anywhere in the world. Laws against interracial marriage there started to be introduced at the time of the original 13 colonies back in the late 1600s. And lasted, as I mentioned before, until 1967. Now, these laws varied according to the state, but out of the 50 states in the US today, 41 of them had interracial marriage prohibitions at some time or another. Now, the type of prohibition was different from state to state, but they were generally worded in terms of the races that were not allowed to marry whites. For example, in South Carolina, Georgia, and Virginia, the ban applied to all non-white races, whereas in Texas and Maryland, it just applied to blacks and Filipinos. The other races that were banned from marrying whites, depending on the state, were Asians, Indians, Native Americans, and Native Hawaiians. Anti-miscegenation laws were gradually introduced in various states over the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, including as many new states were becoming established. At the same time, some states in the mid to late 19th century also began repealing their anti-miscegenation laws. These were mostly the states of the North and West, such as Massachusetts, Illinois, Michigan, Iowa, and Ohio. But a lot of states steadfastly held on to their laws. In the first half of the 20th century, 30 states were still actively enforcing their laws against interracial marriage. In 1913, a Democrat member of the House of Representatives, Seaborn Roddenberry, proposed an amendment to the United States Constitution to ban interracial marriage throughout the entire country. Let me quote a little bit here from a speech he made to the US Congress. Now, he was from Georgia, so I'll try to do it in my best Georgian accent. No brutality, no infamy, no degradation in all the years of Southern slavery possessed such villainous character and such atrocious qualities as the provision of the laws of Illinois, Massachusetts, and other states which allow the marriage of the Negro to a woman of Caucasian strain. Intermarriage between whites and blacks is repulsive and averse to every sentiment of pure American spirit. It is abhorrent and repugnant to the very principles of Saxon government. It is subversive of social peace. It is destructive of moral supremacy. And ultimately, this slavery of white women to black beasts will bring this nation a conflict as fatal as ever reddened the soil of Virginia or crimsoned the mountain paths of Pennsylvania. Let us uproot and exterminate now this debasing, ultra-demoralizing, un-American and inhuman leprosy. And you thought that politicians today could sometimes get a little bit carried away with their rhetoric. Well, you ain't seen nothing. It's also interesting to compare this kind of rhetoric with the arguments used today by some people against same-sex marriage. Obviously not quite so colourful, shall we say, but you can definitely see echoes of those kinds of sentiments. Anyway, back to the history. Roddenberry's proposed constitutional amendment failed, fortunately. Another congressman tried again in 1928 and also thankfully failed. Now, after Ohio repealed its anti-miscegenation law back in 1887, there was a period of about 60 years in which other states were introducing these laws but not repealing them. It was really only after World War II that the constitutionality of these laws was brought into question, and a growing number of states finally started to get rid of their interracial marriage bans. This wave of repeal really began in 1948 with the California Supreme Court decision of Perez versus Sharp, which found that anti-miscegenation laws violated the 14th Amendment of the US Constitution. But even in the 1950s, interracial marriage was still a big taboo in the United States. In a 1958 Gallup poll, 94% of Americans did not approve of interracial marriage. Only 4% approved and 2% didn't know. Yes, dear listener, you heard right. A 94% disapproval rate of interracial marriage as recently as 1958. I have to say, I couldn't believe this figure when I first read it, but then I went and found it on the Gallup poll website itself. Amazing. Anyway, that figure has changed now, fortunately. In 2007, it had fallen to 17% who disapproved of interracial marriage and 77% now approve, which is a huge turnaround there in 50 years. So, during the 50s and 60s, you saw 14 more states repeal their interracial marriage bans after California had done so in 1948. And then finally, the issue was resolved once and for all in 1967 with the historic decision of the US Supreme Court in the appropriately named Loving versus Virginia. In 1958, an interracial couple, Richard and Mildred Loving, who had got married in Washington, D.C., but were living in the state of Virginia, were arrested in their bedroom for the crime of living together as an interracial couple. This case eventually got all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which found that anti-miscegenation laws were indeed unconstitutional. At that point, the interracial marriage bans, which still existed in 16 states, almost all of them in the South, automatically became invalid. And that's where our story ends. But I think there are a lot of similarities here between today's fight for same-sex marriage and the fight half a century ago for interracial marriage. The northern states being more progressive and leading the way, the occasional threat of amendments to the US Constitution, the changing opinion polls as public opinion inevitably shifts in favor of tolerance, the influence of religion to support discrimination, even the type of language used in the debates. The battles are following very similar trajectories, and you really see a lot of similarities between them. So I think we have reason to take heart. As I mentioned, when Keith Bardwell refused to marry that interracial couple in Louisiana a few weeks ago, it caused a national outrage in the US, as well it should. And yet, just 50 years ago, 94% of the population probably would have supported him. And I think it's probably a safe bet to say that in less than 50 years from now, if a justice of the peace refuses to marry a same-sex couple, it will create the same level of national outrage. I hope so anyway. And just as the repeal of the anti-miscegenation laws went along gradually, state by state, until the last 16 were finally overturned by a Supreme Court decision, I think it's relatively predictable that same-sex marriage is going to follow a similar kind of path in the United States. Massachusetts was the first to get it in 2004, then Connecticut in 2008, then Iowa and Vermont got it this year. New Hampshire will get it in the new year, and maybe we'll also see it in Washington, D.C., New York, and New Jersey in the very near future. So I don't think it takes a genius to see how this is going to pan out in the U.S. over the coming years. And it will probably end with a U.S. Supreme Court decision applicable to the whole country. Actually, that decision might come sooner rather than later with the current Olson Boys case now moving through the U.S. federal courts. We'll just have to wait and see when it comes, but I think you can be pretty sure it will eventually come. Let us listen to our last song now, but before we do, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover, please do send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too to hear past episodes of Reality Check. That's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song for today. And when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. Joy. 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was Eden by Belgian pop group Hooverphonic from the year 1998. Okay, we're in the final part of the show now, which means it's time for this week's movie review. And the film up for review today is the latest documentary from Michael Moore, Capitalism, A Love Story. Now, Michael Moore, I'm sure, needs no introduction to the listeners of Reality Check. He's the guy who's produced a series of hugely successful documentaries over the last 20 years, beginning with Roger and Me in 1989. His four most recent documentaries, Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, Sicko, and the one we're reviewing today, Capitalism, A Love Story, are four of the top eight highest grossing documentaries of all time. So one thing you can say about Michael Moore is he knows how to appeal to an audience. And I say good on him, because although I do have my gripes with certain elements of his style, I've got to say that it's pleasing to me to know that his message is reaching a wide audience. The more he gets the word out about the deep problems within the United States that most Americans themselves don't see, I think the better off the world will be. And the particular problem that he's tackling in his latest outing is nothing more and nothing less than the evils of capitalism, or more precisely, the largely unfettered form of capitalism that has been allowed to reign in the United States since Ronald Reagan came to power in the early 1980s. Now, first I'm going to get my gripes with this documentary out of the way, and then I'll tell you why I like it. My main gripe with Capitalism, A Love Story is the same gripe I've had with a few of Michael Moore's documentaries, and that is that he's not very focused. Remember when you had to learn how to write an argumentative essay in high school English class? You had to follow a certain formula, first the introduction, then three paragraphs, point, counterpoint, point, counterpoint, point, counterpoint, and then finally the conclusion, or something along those lines. Well, although I appreciate Michael Moore's colourful style and his humour and the varieties of approaches that he has to getting his message across, I think I'd still prefer a slightly more disciplined and well-reasoned argument. This is my argument. Here is my supporting evidence. Here's how the evidence supports my argument, and here's my argument one more time. Instead, Michael Moore tends to ramble on a bit, leaping off on tangents, then coming back for a while, then heading off in a totally different direction, often at breakneck speed. It's all very entertaining, I'll give him that, which is why he's had, obviously, so much success at the box office, but it doesn't always make for a convincing argument. And some of the things that he includes in Capitalism, A Love Story are really only marginally relevant. For example, at one point he visits a young family who are grieving over the loss of the mother, who was a Walmart employee, and we see the young son and family members weeping in real grief, but for no real reason that was relevant to the point that Michael Moore was making. And to see something so personal and so distressing was just unnecessary and almost exploitative, I reckon. The other thing that Michael Moore does quite often is that he only gives one side of an argument or one part of a wider story, and it's normally pretty obvious that he's doing that. For example, we see people who have had their house taken away from them because they couldn't keep up the mortgage payments, which is tragic for them and distressing for everyone involved, distressing to watch as well. But we're just supposed to presume that it wasn't their fault in any way. We don't get any background details. We just get the raw emotional impact that comes from seeing people evicted from their homes. And then you also have the Catholic priests that he interviews, and they're all very kind and benevolent and very eloquent on the social evils that arise from uncontrolled capitalism, and we're kind of led to believe that that's the general view of the Catholic Church, when it quite obviously is not. Just look at how the Catholic Church has so often sided with the rich, powerful and corrupt in Latin America for centuries now. He also portrays Obama as a kind of savior to the American working class and middle class. But if he's being so critical of everyone else, it becomes kind of obvious that he's treating Obama with kid gloves, and it does look a bit like a double standard. And there were also some points that Michael Moore just glossed over briefly in the documentary, and yet would have made fascinating fodder themselves for an entire documentary. For example, at one point he mentions how it is that politicians, together with the owners of corporations, how they should be serving the people, and the people should have a lot of power in a democracy where you have a one-person, one-vote system. And yet, those in power, the politicians and the corporation owners, manage to convince the poor and the masses to vote for candidates who work against their interests. Now, that in itself would make a fascinating documentary, and yet it's only mentioned briefly in passing in Capitalism, A Love Story. And I could go on and on with all my nitpicking, but I don't want to give the impression that I didn't enjoy this film. I really did enjoy it, and mainly because it's so refreshing to see Michael Moore's passion and to see him, an American, saying things to other Americans that are so obvious to most people in the rest of the world and yet bizarrely kind of taboo in the United States. Of course, unfettered capitalism causes many social ills. For most foreign visitors flying into any big city of the United States, particularly visitors from a wealthy liberal democracy with a social welfare system, it's kind of immediately obvious what the problems with unregulated capitalism are. All those decaying inner cities, all those ghettos, all those poor people and the homeless and all that poverty. And yet Americans themselves often seem blind to it. And there is also a nasty and powerful streak within American society that says, I earned my money and I'm not going to let the state take any of my money away to give it to anybody else. Which obviously leads to poor public services and huge disparities of wealth. So when Michael Moore points out the obvious problems with such a system, it's quite a pleasure to watch. And in fact, Capitalism, A Love Story, the whole movie, despite its flaws, despite its rapid pace and its scattergun approach to facts, is a pleasure to watch. I just hope that the millions and millions of poor and disadvantaged in the United States get to watch it and change their minds about who to vote for. Well, one can always live in hope. And that brings us to the end of the 15th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 16. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.